Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be joined again today by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project. How was your weekend, Josh?
You know, well, mixed, I guess. It's funny. Wait, this last weekend? It just happened?
Was that a weekend?
Oh. It was great.
Good answer.
It was great. All weekends are great.
All right. Well, over the weekend, on Saturday to be exact, the Texas Senate voted to reject all of the impeachment articles passed by the House against Ken Paxton, in case you haven't heard, reinstating him as Attorney General. This has been covered in great, great detail in the Texas press and you know, the various reading sources that you probably have if you're listening to this. But there was a bit of variance on the Democratic side on a count or two. One of them in particular, I think on the open records request, didn't convince even a lot of Democrats. But for the most, and two Republicans voted in favor of most of the articles. That is, and that would be Kelly Hancock and
Senator Nichols.
And of course, Senator Robert Nichols. But the vote was largely along party lines. In essence, Republicans delivered for the Attorney General. After a summer of speculation about whether Republican senators would be willing to follow the House in holding fellow Republican accountable for these, you know, relatively serious and documented charges, and we'll get to what that means, you know, soon enough. Paxton has been returned to office. You know, there's been a lot of biblical allusions through this whole trial. Just before we came up for the podcast, there's a relatively new post at Texas Monthly, and forgive me, I don't remember the author. I just kind of saw it before I came up and read through it on kind of religious underpinnings and themes in Senator Paxton's postings throughout the trial. When we post on that, we'll do a post for this podcast, and I'll try to include a link on that if we can remember to do that. Very interesting if you're interested in that kind of thing. I would say that as biblical allusions go, there was a lot of New Testament during the trial. I think we will be shifting into an Old Testament mode. I'm not a biblical scholar, but I would go with the Old Testament use. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord.
A little smitier.
I think we will be, yes, a little smitier. I think it's very good. There will be some smiting going on, I think, in the aftermath of this by the victors. So, you know, we'll talk a lot about the dynamics and, you know, within the chamber, within the jury, within the legislature, the vote. But I think Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, characteristically, to some degree, was able to draw a lot of attention to himself with his comments immediately after the vote. And so immediately after the votes were taken and the results registered, Lieutenant Governor Patrick, who had presided over the trial after repeatedly invoking both the importance of and providing a guarantee of impartiality in the process, weighed in after the voting was done to just excoriate the House. I think that's a fair word.
Yeah, I think so.
Saying they engaged in a flawed process and claiming that sending the charges to the Senate was fundamentally flawed and without foundation and violated the spirit, if not the letter, of the Constitution. Now, those comments were couched, at least initially, in terms of getting some procedural notes on the historical record.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, you know, and along those lines, Patrick also called for constitutional changes to the process and for an audit, you know, and for an audit of what the impeachment investigation and the trial, the whole shebang, right, cost. And he made that formal request to the auditor on Monday of this week, I believe.
My guess is it would have been cheaper to pay the settlement.
Well, you know, almost certainly, I guess. and this was quite a turn. And you know, what do we? So this was quite a turn, both
Right.
Patrick's comments and the outcome itself. Lots to unpack in terms of explaining, you know, our understanding, which is going to be necessarily incomplete, I think, is an important thing to point out here. You know, the why and how this happened, the weighting of different factors, and what the fallout will be. And I guess, you know, we should probably start with a conversation, a couple of conversations we've had about this.
Yeah.
One, in this, the search for the one thing, which I think is important to flag, because you can start digging into the multiple elements here. But like most things, and I think especially in this case, there's not one factor that's going to explain all this, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you and I are in an interesting position because we get asked to comment, you know, on these, you know, sort of current happenings sort of in real time and provide some sort of context, some sort of, you know, I like to think of it like helpful commentary to give people a better understanding of what's going on, more so than an argument one way or the other. And in the aftermath of this, I think there's a rush one to hot takes, which is fine. I mean, whatever, that happens.
Nature of the thing.
Right, I think now. It's nature of the thing. But I think in something like this, it's actually, you know, fairly complex, and complex in a particular way. I think it leads to hot takes that in some way are actually less clarifying than they sound. I mean, I think, you know, you get advantage in some ways by being someone who comments confidently about this sort of stuff. But if you said to me right now, hey, what one factor explains what happened? I mean, I'm going to be very resistant to tell you it was this, because really this is what we talked about this on the podcast before. There's a lot of factors that probably were pushing in a similar direction towards this outcome. And so given that, and we'll kind of unpack some of that, I think now, to say that it was this one factor over other factors, in some ways, I think it doesn't really clarify, because what's actually going on is there's a lot of things we can't disentangle the relative impact of all of these different elements that we're going to talk about here to sort of getting to the outcome that we got to. And so what it means is that anybody who says, oh, well, you know, it's because the House and the Senate hate each other, and that's what this is. It's like, yeah, look, no doubt that contributed. Like, we're
yes,
absolutely. You know. Some people said, oh, well, you know, national, you know, forces. It's like, yeah, I mean, sure, national forces come in and maybe activating forces that exist. You know, we can kind of go into these, but it's not going to be one thing in such a complicated process filled with players all with their own set of, you know, risk reward calculations for how to behave in a process that honestly was evolving as it's happening.
And
changing as it's happening.
And we'll circle back to some of the kind of meta implications of that and why there's such a tendency to look for the one thing. And then the other thing I kind of want to talk about, you know, is you know, the language. And I think this is both an observation, you know, this is I think for both of us, it's both an observation and a caveat.
Yeah.
Right, which is, so was Ken and I've already sort of dipped into this in the intro.
Yeah.
Was Ken Paxton exonerated? Was he found not guilty? Was he, you know, how do we talk about this? Was the case made or not made? And, you know, why we're flagging this, I think, will become clear as we talk more. But the language here is even very tricky to some degree in how you talk about this and the kind of impression certain kind of language leaves. And I think it's even more important because I spent some time in the last day going and, you know, trying to track what some of the actors are saying. What kind of language is Ken Paxton going to use? I mean, sort of more to the front of my mind, what kind of language are the senators using? What kind of language is Lieutenant Governor Patrick using in describing this outcome?
Yeah, and I mean, and even just to put meat on that bones, and we'll probably talk about this a little bit more directly. I'll be quick, but I mean, you can imagine Paxton saying, I was completely exonerated. You see Patrick going, and again, like a lot of the defenders of Paxton in the House, you know, really pointing to the process and how that led them to basically have no other conclusion. But then you're also seeing senators who voted to acquit actually saying, well, you know, the burden of proof was so very, very high.
Right.
Which is a very different message, right?
Right.
And so again, for people like us trying to understand what happened, it's very easy to sort of slip into sort of your own assumptions about how convincing or unconvincing the evidence was, and then thinking about the actions in terms of your own baseline expectations. Because look, if you're a conservative, you know, Republican primary voter who heard all the messages and completely thought that Ken Paxton was being railroaded by Democrats and rhinos or something like that, then regardless of how they got to the endpoint, it was the right outcome. And no other analysis that doesn't, you know, take that into account would be right. But I think we just have to acknowledge here that people are coming at this with different sets of baseline assumptions about what exactly happened, what the process produced, and that's sort of what I think also makes
What the process should have been.
And I think that makes interpretation, again, something that is very you know, conditional on a lot of things.
Right. And so, and the language there is
which
very,
also, yeah.
So the language is very conditional.
And that makes, again, coming to really strong convictions, you kind of have to say, well, okay. You know.
Well, okay, so you can, you know, that, yeah, you know, that kind of points towards, you know, a starting point.
Let's start.
So, you know, being trained as academics, yes, at least. And I've started with this a lot in terms of in talking about this to people that have asked about it and talking to reporters and et cetera. You know, I think if we start with institutional factors, mm-hmm, I mean, we talked about these a lot.
Yeah.
Particularly when the rules were written, mm-hmm, and when it began to become, you know, I shouldn't say began to become more clear. That's not the wrong, the right way to put it. We thought about this a lot, mm-hmm, when the Senate received the case and was discussing the rules and passing the rules, and we were kind of trying to read the tea leaves on what was in the, mm-hmm, rules. And, you know, there's this very lengthy discussion that repeated itself in a lot of different ways throughout the process that looked at what was going on as this, you know, mainly political, but also a hybrid of the legal and the political. But in the end, I think you have to say that the trial rules adopted by the Senate turned out to matter a lot.
It certainly looks like they did.
You know, I mean, it's certainly they're mattering a lot in the post hoc explanation.
Yeah.
And I, you know, as we hear snippets about what happened, mm-hmm, during the deliberation process and the internal dynamics in the Senate, mm-hmm, as the case was unfolding, a couple of aspects of that, two or three aspects of that loom very large. I would say the beyond a reasonable doubt standard, as you kind of alluded to, yeah, as it was a good transition, turned out to be very important. I mean, and I think, you know, we sort of recognize this, particularly as Paxton's defense sought to take explicit advantage of it during the course of the trial. I mean, this was a high bar. But it wasn't just that it was objectively a high bar in the way that we would think about it in a criminal trial.
Right.
It was a high bar in the sense of creating latitude for the senators that did not have strong dispositions going in, or for one reason or another, shall we say, you know, were very fluid in their decision making and how they were going to approach this. And just to put, you know, some empirical, yeah, you know, I mean, if Senator Drew Springer, who was somebody who was thought of as being somewhere from a swing vote,
yeah,
to a kind of high probability yes to convict,
yeah,
I think inside the political community, he was not one of the Paxton Six,
right,
in terms of the early dismissal votes, you know, invoked this in terms of his, you know, his explanation for why in the end, you know, he voted against the impeachment articles. And he was fairly explicit in saying that, you know, it was close, and had the threshold been lower,
yeah, preponderance of the evidence or whatever.
Yeah, had it been a preponderance of the evidence kind of argument, you know, and he sort of clouded this a little bit with, you know, the difficulty in,
yeah,
separating out what was in the public realm and what was in the evidence,
yeah,
et cetera. I mean, he sort of there were a lot of, you know,
yeah, a lot of hedges in there.
Yeah, yeah, there were a lot of, you know, trial balloons launched, and this is, you know, and the source on this is in one of Springer, one of the newspapers in Springer's district,
mm-hmm,
and I don't have the link right here with me. It's been pretty commonly linked to in the last 12 hours. We'll put this on the website too, but then also it's not just the latitude that it gave those that might have been on the fence or that were sort of waiting to sort of see what developments look like. We also have heard a lot about this from those who voted in the attorney, you know, essentially in the attorney general's favor. You can go to the Chad Hastie show and in podcast form, Senator Paul Betancourt, one of the, you know, the quote unquote Paxton Six, he had voted to dismiss in the, mm-hmm, beginning, but also, you know, invoked this in his discussion of this among a lot of other things. So functionally, you know, this had a lot. This was a big thing. So I said a few things. There's also the denominator for determining the two-thirds threshold for,
right,
conviction, including Senator Paxton, right?
Right. And two senators who, you know, under any other, you know, and on, let me just put it this way. As the rules that were adopted, right, essentially they gave the defense essentially the strongest protections as a criminal defendant would receive, as opposed to a civil trial where, again, the burden would be less, the protections would be less. Yet at the same time, included in the denominator for figuring out how many votes would be required to get to two-thirds, his wife.
Right.
The defense wife. Someone named in one of the impeachment charges, and Senator Hughes.
Right.
And someone directly involved with one of the key witnesses who didn't make it to the stand, interestingly, you know, Paxson's alleged mistress who worked for Senator Donna Campbell.
Right. Now, at some point, yes.
At some point. And is right. any, and I think as any, you know, sort of any person with any sort of legal knowledge would point out, in no jury trial would anyone with this kind of a connection to the case be seated as a juror. Now, look, this is not a normal jury trial. Right. But this is where...
And, you know, look, to be fair to that decision on the Senate Rules Committee that... That Lieutenant Governor Patrick put together, it's a fair reading of the Constitution to say that that had to be the denominator. Nonetheless, that was a decision.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I also know that, I mean, this is sort of, you know, it's interesting. I mean, we initially started, we go right into like the rules and you say we're going to be good political scientists. But this is the thing, when you're, you know, I mean, this is true. I mean, when you're looking at sort of outcomes in an institution in political science, especially in a legislative body, which this is, it's not a trial. The first thing you look at is the rules.
Right.
Because the rules explain a lot about this. And to your point, I agree with you. I think that probably, you know, push came to shove. If the trial got held up because of the rules they adopted may violate the Constitution, which I think, you know, I don't put it past them to push that. And by them, I mean the defense to push that argument. I'm not sure that they would have said, no, it's got to be all the senators, you know, present. These are the senators that have to be present.
Had they not done that, it would have been challenged in a defense motion.
At the same time, it's not a de facto truth that the Senate couldn't have adopted different rules.
Right. And then, you know, I mean, I kind of said three, and then, you know, there are lots of others. But I think the third you have to say is the fact that the lieutenant governor
presided over the trial.
He was empowered to do so, but he was also empowered to step aside for somebody that was more neutral. And certainly in the aftermath of the speech he gave after the trial, there's a lot of doubt has been cast on his neutrality, and I think that is a legitimate source of doubt. I mean, I don't understand how you can read that speech and not feel like, well, this certainly sounds like he had a view of the process that was in place at the outset, and he did nothing to dispel that. He was also on the Chad Hastie show yesterday, and he did nothing to dispel that. There's a certain air of, and this is a little bit glib, but I think it's not too much. It was like, well, you just got to, you know, trust me. I kept, you know, he sort of said, I kept my mouth shut essentially, and I presided fairly over this thing I knew was completely unfair. And I think that's, given that he had the option of stepping aside and didn't take it, I don't know how you don't factor that into the consideration of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of impossible. And you kind of imagine, you know, if a district court judge in Austin had, you know, issued some consequential opinion on state government and then basically said immediately after issuing the opinion, okay, I'm not a judge anymore, but let me tell you, you know, basically how screwed up I think the state is on this. And I've always thought this. And by the way, this actually fits into a long running battle that I have, you know, with state agency. It's like you'd be like, that person would probably be removed from the bench.
And then, the whole factor of the money that was given him by the Texas Liberty Pact, you know, all of the financial pieces that we talked about in
which
here.
Which were problematic when they happened.
That have been well aired out. All of that together, you know, I mean, those are political factors, but I think you also have to, you know, it's very easy to look at them through an institutional frame if you're going to assess what the institutional factors in this process were. And so it raises the question of how neutral Patrick was.
Well, you're right. And the way you said it, I think, is perfect just a minute ago, which is to say, like, you know, basically you have to take all these factors that seem to point in one direction and then basically take the other side of it is, trust me.
Yeah.
I was just a judge then. It's fine. And it's sort of like, well, you know, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's been made a challenge. I think there's an argument to be made for almost all the other things. And I think the things that are harder with evidence, like the way that, you know, he was ruling on motions throughout the trial and ruling on objections and things like that, that's a much tougher thing to kind of parse out and sort of figure out if there's a direction to that or whatever. But the fact is, I mean, I think the smoking gun, if you will, on that piece of it is the trial ends and not the next day on the Chad Hastie show, not in a press release immediately.
Yeah. No.
This was written up and ready to go.
Part of the trial record.
Yeah, it's part of the trial record is basically what his opinion was on these charges.
Yeah.
Apparently had no influence on anything he did.
And as a footnote to that, and this bears not much on where we are, but I just can't help but mention it. I mean, you know, I think people were sort of disingenuous and say initially critics of Patrick were like, oh, wow, you know, and again, on social media, the source of, you know, all kinds of straw men for stupidity. But, you know, it's like, oh, so I guess he just wrote that speech after the verdict. Well, of course he didn't.
Yeah.
Nobody serious really thought that. But he did say on the Chad Hastie show again that, you know, he had two speeches.
I'd love to see the other one.
And so I think, the question I would raise is what is the legal status, and this is for my lawyer friends, what is the legal status of that other draft?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, you know, will we see that? Do we have to wait to see that in the archives? If he wants to burn it, can he burn it? I would like to see that other speech as well. So I just wanted to flag that. I didn't know if you would listen to that. Yeah. He did say, yeah, I've got another one. I've got the other one. I wrote two. It was very interesting.
It's proof of his neutrality, right?
Yeah. So
or something.
Okay. So, you know, what else, what else might we ask about this? I think we could do this in different orders. Let's start. I mean, to me, one of the things that looms very large here that I think got lost in a lot of the run-up, to my mind, and if you're somebody that included this, you know, in one of your stories, if you're a journalist, I'm not saying nobody wrote about this. So, if you want to send me something, fine. But I think something that did get short shrift, particularly in national reporting, was the friction between the House and the Senate and between Dan Patrick and Dade Phelan. Again, not to, just be monomaniacal in our focus on Patrick's speech, but it is a rich text. It seems to have loomed large, at least in the lieutenant governor's mind.
Yeah, I mean, when this started, we recorded a podcast after the House delivered its impeachment articles. I said something at the time to you, and I know I said to other people also, which is, the analogy I use was, a flaming bag of dog poop on someone's doorstep. In this case, it was the Senate's doorstep, right? It was the end of the session. There'd been a lot of acrimony that had ratcheted up over property taxes, over school vouchers, and ultimately, has been building session after session, essentially, as the House does not meet, basically the lieutenant governor's expectations. We'll just put it that way, right? So this is an ongoing story. And when the House essentially kicked this over to them, to the Senate, I mean, one of the things I was thinking at the time was, if nothing else, this is just a big mess for them to deal with. And I'm not sure that wasn't. And look, again, this is going back to the whole, you can't say, oh, was that why the House did it? No, I don't think that's why the House did it. I think there's a lot of factors why the House impeached Paxton, right, including Paxton.
Or why the Senate voted the way they did.
Or why the Senate voted the way they did. But it doesn't mean that this wasn't. Again, when the individual House members were weighing up their various considerations, including the evidence that was available to them, including whatever else they wanted to weigh, the politics of it, who knows, and in choosing to ratify, those articles of impeachment sent to the Senate, I don't think it's unlikely that for some members, part of this, what was fun was like, okay, well, now the Senate's going to have to deal with this mess. And in some ways, Patrick's speech was the bookend of that. Yeah. It was basically to say, yeah, you know what? You did put a flaming bag of turds on my front step. And you know what? I dealt with it, and now I'm going to try to throw it back, at your car or whatever, right. whatever the follow up is to that,
Yeah, no, I mean, I think
a lot of feces thrown.
The thought experiment that I sort of engaged in at one point was, if you were somebody that watched the process, mm-hmm, and you watched the House deliver the impeachment to the Senate, mm-hmm, and then the following week or so, you watch the House come back in the special session.
You went to a coma or something.
Side with the governor and then adjourn. Mm-hmm. So two, is basically another bag. Oh, by the way, here, have another.
Yeah.
And then you left Austin because the weather was too bad and you went someplace where you had no media access or you couldn't follow the process. And then you drop back into town about the time that Patrick was giving this speech. Yeah. You'd kind of go, well, it seems like I didn't miss much.
Yeah, nothing happened.
It's still, this is still going and just getting worse.
Right.
And so, I think that, that gets missed, I think, in a lot of, again, from a national perspective on this. And you really can't, I think any explanation that looks at this dynamic, mm-hmm, and it, of course, leads you to other ways, which, will lead us to the next factor, another factor. Right. It overlaps with other things, but there is something right there that, again, is right at the it's like the intersection of two, major thoroughfares, mm-hmm, of politics and institutional factors, right?
Yeah.
Where they're over, it's ideology and institutions, right? I mean, there's, mm-hmm, just, and they're really fueling a lot of conflict that clearly is at play and is continuing and is only going to get worse.
The thing is, and I mean, I'd said this before, and I think this is true, Patrick woke up that day and chose violence. You know, as I said, yeah. I mean, because look, I think, you know, I'd said all along, you know, my expectation was that they were going to acquit him, and what they were going to say was, and even the Republicans who didn't vote to dismiss the charges early on, it would have been easy enough to say, these are serious charges, we're going to listen to the evidence, but you know what, we listen to the evidence. In some cases, what they already says, it either, they actually, I thought they'd say, and it wasn't enough to remove someone from office. We respect this process too much. Now, they found another way, which is to say, at least again, among the sort of a lot of the senators who seem to have some misgivings about their vote or feel like they need to explain it, they pointed to the high burden of proof as sort of an out for them, because that allows them to say, they're not really saying what they thought either way. They're saying, well, the burden of proof was so high.
Yeah.
Right. And that kind of gets them out of it. Patrick could have said something similar. It's like, we agreed that this was the burden. It was a high burden. He could say, hey, look, this wasn't enough. But instead he said, this is the House's fault.
Yeah.
He threw more gas on the fire when it wasn't entirely necessary, but that's a choice that's been made now. So it really is an escalation.
You know, one of the things that I think we've talked about in here and certainly, you know, has been discussed is that, and is reflected in the point you're making, is that if you assume that, you know, look, one of the biggest questions all along was where is the lieutenant governor in all of this? What are his priorities given his obvious control and influence over the Senate and his large role in the political system writ large?
Right.
And if you were to say, oh, you know, what are, you know, Dan Patrick's top five priorities here? I don't think looking out for Ken Paxton was in the top five.
No.
You know, maybe, you know, certainly one in the top three. And I think the way that you put that, you know, it was interesting is Lieutenant Governor Patrick did not spend any time in that speech saying, and by the way, this really shows you that Ken Paxton did not deserve any of this and is a great guy. It was just, you know, thumping on the House and to move on to a kind of another factor here. And invoking and re-inflaming the factional politics in the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, I can't help but point this out. It doesn't matter. I just have to say it. But I mean, the idea that he's excoriating the House for basically their rushed process while lauding the Senate for basically limiting the amount of time that they could devote to this incredibly important task was like, again, you can't follow politics closely if you get too upset or worked up about
it. Obsessed with consistency?
Yeah, but I mean, that moment in and of itself to me was just amazing just for what it was. But it also shows that, you know, and maybe it wasn't really about the process.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, I think, let's talk about the factional
I mean, politics here.
You know, the House-Senate conflict obviously overlaps in complex ways. And I you know, it's tricky to sort this out, and we'll try to do this in a reasonable way. You know, with the factional politics in the Republican Party, and it's tricky because, you know, and we've said in here, but just to sort of hit the point again, I think, you know, for immediate use, you know, It's oversimplifying to say that, as some people will try to say, and I think it sort of favors one side over the other, to say that the Senate is the conservative chamber and the House is the moderate chamber or the less conservative chamber, or because I think there's a lot of evidence that you can look at output, vote analyses, a lot of different things that say that, you know, we're talking about a pretty narrow ideological spectrum here. You have to parse this very carefully. That's not to say that the quote unquote movement / dissident conservatives don't have more sway in the Senate than they do in the House, because I think they do.
Yeah.
But it is to say that you can't just sort of put the get an ideological space and say, oh, Senate's here, House is here, and the Senate is just the more conservative body.
Yeah, and just, you know, I mean, just for the sake of it, I mean, it's interesting the way you put that, because it is sort of, you're actually talking about two different things. You know, in some ways, I think you actually see this is true across both chambers. On the votes that you can, that get taken.
Right.
I think you can see more of the ideological spread and the division that exists in the House, because one, there are more members, there are more numbers, but two, there's no Patrick.
Yeah.
Who is standing over it, who is going to say, if you don't vote this way, this is what's going to happen.
And the House process is very different than the Senate
process. The House process is very different. And it's not even the case that Patrick even needs to say to a senator who wants to vote against a conservative priority of his, you don't vote against that. That senator knows that he or she cannot vote against that without the possibility of engendering some kind of retaliation. And I think even on this trial, there's been a lot of accounts kind of floating around out there that, you know, there were probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 19 to 20 votes overall that would have gone for a conviction. But once those Republicans learned that they weren't going to get to 21 against where the numbers come in against, kind of important, that basically there was no benefit to them to actually, you know, take a principled stand on the evidence, because ultimately they were just going to get punished both by Patrick directly. He doesn't need to say that. And right. But also by outside groups, potentially by voters, by
now,
who
to be
knows.
Fair to Patrick, he has plausible deniability on
yeah,
that. I mean, this
absolutely.
Is an interpretation on our part.
No, but. It's absolutely. I'm applying what is, I think, a pretty well-known and standard mode of operation when we talk about most legislative affairs, votes,
right.
bills, things like that. Does it apply to this process? Well, I'd like to say no, but again, looking at what we've seen, it's kind of hard to think that this is totally different.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it would be naive to think that just because this is institutionally a different process and nominally a different process, that it's not taking place in the context of the Texas Senate as run by Dan Patrick.
Yeah, it's very easy to sort of maximize the distance between the two chambers, when in reality, if you were to just, you know, look at the preferences of the individual members in each chamber, they'd probably be closer looking than I think some of the conflict suggests on some of these big issues.
Yeah.
Because really you're talking about Patrick, who is very conservative and has very conservative policy priorities, and a House that has a little bit more ideological heterogeneity on this stuff.
Right.
Okay.
So, yeah, I agree with that. So, you know. So one aspect of this has been then, you know, in terms of like the assessing where factional politics played into this, the drumbeat from the very beginning of this process right. back in the spring from, you know, again, language, what are we going to call them? The dissident right groups.
I like the dissident right. I think, and I like, you use it a while ago. The reason I like it, and I just want to say, is the way that I think about it is that we know that there are individuals on the far right of the party, especially in the House, who have been to some degree outside of the levers of power. They've been incorporated
right.
in by leadership sort of session over session, really going back to beginning in the Tea Party wave
sure.
and then kind of going to now. But I mean, when we talk about what is ultimately underlying, you know, a lot of this sort of angst and stuff, it's agenda control and it's about power, right?
Yeah. And
they don't drive the agenda to the extent that they'd like to or feel that they should.
And I like the term dissident to as a shorthand for that. And also, you know, it's also, you know, it's a little bit of a, it's a slightly more both flexible, but also a little more, maybe a little bit more precise than just saying ins versus outs. Although there's an aspect of that.
Yeah.
I mean, look, it's not.
I like this, yeah, because it shows a range, because sometimes they're in, sometimes they're out.
Right, two of the loudest voice pro-Paxton voices, you know, are former House members
mm-hmm.
who's made a judgment at some point that they were no longer viable in the House. Now, there's all kinds of other
yeah.
rationales for deciding to leave the House, but in situations. And so all of that kind of leads to, an interesting sidelight here that I think both of us want to talk about. And that is, you know, there was an interesting Axios story that it was credited to Mike Allen, the head of Axios, and, you know, sort of, you know, came from Politico, you know, really a DC guy. You know, Axios being primarily an email outlet, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
The subject line and headline is a scoop in all capitals that, based on his sourcing, it was supposed to be a sort of a big part of the explanation here, or the explanation
uh-huh.
that sort of national right-wing forces had worked through these dissident forces, you know, elements
yeah.
in the state to pressure potential anti-Paxton senators or anti-Paxton votes in the Senate
yeah.
through, you know, email campaigns and phone calls and social media appearances. Now, one of the things that's interesting about the whole, there's two key
yeah.
things I want to focus on. There's a lot that we could focus on. One is there's a lot of pushback from Texas, not a lot, but there was some public and some other behind the scenes pointed pushback from Texas-based journalists about the fact that this was some kind of scoop, because in fact, it was pretty common knowledge. I mean,
yeah.
look, that was part of the strategy.
Yeah.
Steve Bannon and Donald Trump both nationally
right.
declared their allegiances to Paxton and, you know, criticized the House and, you know, echoed and amplified the lines that had been coming from inside the state for quite a long time. Now, there were a few new dots to connect
sure.
that I think were in the Mike Allen story. But I think that it really underlines, you know, this is kind of one of our exhibit A, I think, on this, where we started in terms of not thinking about this as liable to a monocausal explanation, to be too wonky about it. But I mean, to read that angle on the story, I think was to walk away with the impression, among other things, that what really carried the day here was a coordinated effort by national right-wing forces.
Out of state.
From outside the state to kind of come in and Bigfoot this and provide the decisive push in Paxton's defense.
Yeah, I think this is a great example of the sort of overdetermination thing. And what I mean here in some ways is, you know, it's easy to look at the outcome here and say, well, this was politics as usual. And I think a really simple example of like read of politics as usual, the Republicans voted against the Democrats and he got out. It's like, that's not what we mean when we say politics as usual.
Right.
When we're talking about politics as usual in the state of Texas, we're talking about the oversized influence of the activated, engaged segments of the Republican primary electorate, who's a very small share of the Texas population overall, but generally tend to have an outsized influence on most political outcomes, on setting the agenda, and on things like this. Now, look.
And on the other hand, and joined to that, the risk and work sensitivity of incumbent Republicans in the state.
Right. And again, we talked about it here too, especially Senate incumbents who have to face a very large district in which, you know, if you can mobilize a significant share of, again, of this very small share of the district against you and you have a reason.
In low turnout Republican primary elections.
There is always a candidate, but also because of this factional politics argument, there's always funding. And there's funding within the state that has nothing to do with national groups, has nothing to do with, like, Texas is not receiving a bunch of money from out of state to run Republicans in GOP primaries. Full stop. That is not happening.
There's no evidence of that.
Well, not there's no evidence, but just take a step back and think logically. Does anyone out there really think that going into the next election cycle, the priority of national Republican groups is going to be to spend money in Texas on statewide races to move Republicans out of office, to replace them with candidates who might have a lower electoral probability?
Right.
As opposed to maybe, I don't know, spending money in competitive states on the presidential election. I mean, it's kind of insane. But the other piece of this, the overdetermination, is like, if this is politics as usual, this the power of this, what it means is like these are also
politics as usual as we see it or as they see it?
Politics as usual as we see it.
Okay.
So if this is politics as usual as we see it, then what are the other features of that? Well, the other feature that we talk about all along is that, you know, Paxton's biggest strength is with the engaged Republican primary voters. He has cultivated that constituency consistently. Activating that constituency to about an alleged cabal between Democrats and RINOs is something that with in-state forces do on a regular basis. So look, does this mean that the national money that came in and amplified that message or echoed it or reverberated did not have an impact? Sure. I'm sure it did have some kind of an impact, but it's a marginal impact over what is already kind of baseline politics in the state and what was already going on really from the moment the impeachment charges were sent to the Senate.
Right. This is in no way meant to imply, you know, look, we told you because didn't. But that was really apparent in some of the numbers that we published, right? I mean, I think maybe the second post after we released after we released the latest poll results in August from the August poll, you know, I think there was a point in that post that was, this is where Paxton's support is strongest, allowing for the fact that there were, particularly compared to Trump, a lot of people that were reserving judgment in those groups too.
Right.
But nonetheless, if you just looked at the people that weren't reserving judgment, that were expressing a view, Paxton's support, no matter what dimension you looked at, whether, you know, your view of whether this was mostly politics or based on the facts, your view of, you know, your job approval of Paxton, your view of whether the impeachment was justified, your view of whether he should be removed, his support was strongest against those who identified as strong Republicans and especially those who identified as extremely conservative.
Right.
And so, you know, all of that, if you step back, I think underlines, you know, this kind of how the politics of the House-Senate conflict and the ideological factional politics, there's a Venn diagram there that, you know, was, you know, I think not super clearly determined going into this. But, you know, there were some leading indicators that if you were an entrepreneurial, opportunistic, national political figure like a Steve Bannon or these other folks that Mike Allen, I think, is talking to or watching.
Yeah.
You know, that there was, you know, an obvious target for your efforts.
Right.
Everybody also has an incentive now after the fact to call up reporters and say, hey, you know what? We did this.
You know, I love this. There's
I think that's got to be kept in mind here.
Yeah, there's an observation always that, you know, the winners of the, you know, the winners always stick around and claim credit and the losers kind of walk off.
Yeah, yeah. What's the old cliche? I'm sort of proud that I probably can't get this right, that, you know.
There's no coincidence.
You know, failure has a thousand success has a thousand fathers and failure none.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Something like along those lines. All right. So we're going to, you know, we've been going for a while, but let's hit a couple more things and we'll come back and start talking about the future maybe, you know, next week or the week after, but hopefully begin to move to some other things. I will admit to our listeners, I think you're probably interested. I think we've been following the market, but I was looking at the podcast. We're fully aware that probably four of the last six podcasts have been largely Paxton focused. But
we could have done it every day.
Yeah,
we could have done it. Ted Cruz style verdict.
Josh did float it like. So are we just going to do a podcast every day after
Ted Cruz style the verdict?
Right, and I, you know, this gave me stomach and headaches enough as it was. How does this impact Dade Phelan standing in the House?
Yeah, it's a tough one, right? I mean, I think, you know, the question, you know, I think the basic first question I ask is, you know, does this embolden, again, these sort of dissident, you know, forces that exist in the House? I mean, ultimately, you know, it's tough to say. I mean, I think that there's a way to think that he looks weakened because, I mean, if just based on the most basic thing that we talk about a lot in here, which is, you know, the Speaker is usually likes to not be known.
Right. And in that case, this is not helpful.
Dade Phelan's name has been basically taken right through the mud multiple times in the last few weeks, very directly. And, you know, to the extent that blame is being laid, you know, at his feet among conservative Republicans, especially, we'll see what happens. I mean, I think what's interesting, again, to the institutional piece of this, we're still not in a session right now. We're not even in a special session yet. So the legislature is going to go away for a little bit. But, you know, if the trial ended with Patrick being Patrick, you know, which is kind of normal in some ways, and the way that he sort of reinforced this House-Senate, you know, argument. Yeah, the question becomes, do the forces that are aligned against Phelan and again, a majority of House Republicans who put him in that position, do they feel emboldened by this and what do they do with
it? And to be fair, and not to echo the criticism of him, but it would be unfair to not mention this, that put him in this position with the cooperation of a critical mass of Democrats.
For sure.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, I think in some ways you can oversimplify this, but I think as a starting point, you know, is this going to solidify Phelan's support in the face of Patrick's posing of this as, you know, so directly, like, you know, the Senate had to come in and like correct all this crap that the House did? Or how much is it going to activate, in some ways, the House being the House, that even if you're the most successful speaker, there are always a lot of people in the chamber that think, you know, I could do a better job of this. And so, you know, how is, you know, the oppositional, a different version of it, the in-group, out-group tension between the Senate and the House that Patrick is clearly stoking, as are some of his allies.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, if you start looking and reading between the lines of some of the responses of the senators who voted with Paxton, even some who didn't, there's a lot of very complex signaling going on here. Some subtle things going, yeah, you know, look, I was in the House. It was cool, you know. Yeah. I've also been in the Senate now. There's a certain amount of, hey, I don't want to get involved in this, but, you know, maybe mistakes were made. I don't know.
I mean, I always think that if you're a member in one of these bodies and someone can take the arrows for you, you're pretty happy for them to do it till they're dead.
Yes.
And Phelan is going to be that guy.
Right.
The flip side is, I think, you know, the House has shown itself pretty explicitly that one of the dimensions that they have considered in putting a speaker forward the last few sessions has been someone who is going to stand up to Patrick. And really, the question becomes, after all this, does this fundamentally change us in a way that the House is, and again, the majority of House Republicans, are more inclined to put someone in charge who is more sympathetic to Patrick than someone they put in recently? And that seems a little hard for me to imagine at the moment.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. But I think the other scenario is, and, you know, I'm choosing my words carefully here. You don't want to underestimate the opportunism that is always at work. These are, look, politics is always in part. I mean, there's no other area, I think, of life in which, maybe business, in which opportunism can be coded in a positive way as an attribute.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
So, you know, to the extent, you know, to go back to your metaphor, I mean, yep, it's great to have somebody that you can use to absorb arrows
shield, yeah.
until there's no more room to absorb any more arrows. And then what do? You toss them aside and think about
What's next? Yeah.
And so I just don't, you know.
Yeah, again, no, I agree with that.
I don't know what the, you know, look, my gut feeling is that for the most part, people are going to rally around Phelan, but, or at least a sufficiently critical mass
right.
will continue to back him. And I think that's probably the safest bet.
Yeah.
But we're also going to have to see what the politics of the next special session look like. I think it's going to be very critical.
Yeah, and I'll say
you know,
this.
In terms of, you know, giving us more data about and providing, shifting the ground a little bit in terms of, you know, how strong Phelan's support is and if people stick with him or not.
I think that, like I said, the one thing I think you can say is, does this significantly increase the probability that Phelan sees a challenge for Speaker next time around? Yeah, I think it does. I mean, just as I think.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I mean, you know, that's something we can say right now. So, what else? You want to do a couple more of these?
A stronger challenge than he had last time.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. Okay.
You know, I think the last thing we can't, you know, I think we should get out of here soon, but I think we can't do this without also ending with how does this, you know, the interesting question of how this impacts Ken Paxton's standing.
Yeah, let's do that.
To go back, you know, this is in some ways maybe a slightly backhanded plug for Axios. Yeah. You know, Axios led in their Texas.
Yeah, it's on the Dallas one. I think it appeared in at least one of them, but
I think it was also in the AM briefing. Okay. Although it didn't lead, you know, Axios is also leading today with the contention that the trial has raised Paxton's profile by connecting him with a national audience of conservative voters, and that, you know, in the end, this has been, you know, a boosting effort for Paxton. I think you're a little more skeptical of this than I am, but I'm not sure in terms of our early conversations. I might be misreading that wrong. Or
yeah.
I may have just not expressed myself.
No, I mean, I am. I think I'm not saying it's wrong on its face. I just think it's too simple. I mean, the idea, like, you know, it's one of those, like, all publicity is good publicity kind of, like, maxims, which isn't true, you know?
I think that would have been more applicable if he had been convicted, but...
Well, I mean, but even so, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I think to the point where we started on this is actually nice wrapping it up is, you know, what's the takeaway from this? Is the takeaway that Ken Paxton was exonerated, that he was found to have done nothing wrong? I mean, ultimately, you know, we've had 2 weeks where a lot of evidence was presented that was clearly very troubling, even to many of the senators who voted to acquit him. So, right. I mean, I don't necessarily, and I look.
Hence the talk about the threshold being very high.
Yeah. And the other piece, you know, I just don't think that being impeached by a Republican majority legislature in a state that I think people outside the state think of as being dominated by Republicans is so easily rationalized in the way that it's been tried to be rationalized, which is, oh, this is really like rhinos and Democrats. And, you know, I mean, I think if you're a Republican from New Jersey, you're saying, what? Are you kidding me? And I think, you know, that's actually not an unreasonable reaction. So I think there's that piece. The other thing is, I think there's something that, you know, we wrote about this just before, I think, the weekend, about how, you know, the ways in which Ken Paxton's attitudes in Texas, at least towards Ken Paxton, are not synonymous with sort of attitudes towards Donald Trump along these dimensions. You know, we found a lot more benefit of the doubt for Donald Trump. We found over time that generally, regardless of sort of his legal problems, if anything, it solidified the Republicans mostly with him for the most part. We didn't really see that with Paxton. We saw the opposite. We saw that as Republicans learned more about this, they were more likely to be skeptical. They were more likely to say the House was justified. They were more likely to think he might, you know, be removed from, might, maybe should be removed from office. They were more likely to think that the charges were fact-based. And so, you know, to me, part of it is, since everyone's sort of focused on the process and the site, and I think for Paxton, you come out and you say, hey, I was persecuted and exonerated, and I, you know, and I'm just, you know, someone who's generally a little bit reticent. I'm reticent about Donald Trump's national standing because of the fact that the trials, while I don't think that they necessarily, or all the indictments, while I don't think that the actual content of them necessarily matters, I think it's going to affect his campaign. And I think one of the challenges Donald Trump has is in mobilizing people to basically take his grievances as their grievances, you know, which I think, you know, when you're talking about like,
I think it's harder to do as the grievances get more rarefied.
Right. Exactly. So that's a good way to say that. And I think, but yet Donald Trump has been able to do that. But Donald Trump has also demonstrated himself as a uniquely, an incredibly unique political entity. People talk about how he, you know, basically talk about how, you know, Teflon Don and all this stuff and how these things seem to make him stronger and how unique that is. And they seem to be applying that same framing to Paxton. Yet none of the data or evidence indicates that, you know, his level of support among Republicans or the trend in it at all looks anything like Donald Trump over that period of time, in the sense Donald Trump seems to have gotten stronger despite these things. Ken Paxton has definitely gotten weaker in the polling data. And the fact that he was, whatever you want to say the Senate did, let him off, exonerate him, whatever. On its face, that to me doesn't read, okay, now this guy is going to go out there and you know, basically use his grievances and say, oh, you know, you might get impeached too.
All right, let me buttress your argument slightly and then dissent slightly. So by buttress, I mean, part of the problem with that is also that Donald Trump has only gotten stronger to the extent that as the presidential nomination campaign has started, he has demonstrated consistent strength versus the rest of the field.
Right.
His overall numbers are actually a little bit down.
Yeah.
And as we've said in here and as we put in the piece, you know, whether that maintains or not as we get into a more, you know,
real phase.
If he's the nominee and as we get into a more polarized general election, you know, whether those numbers change again or not, open question. But for now, they are down. They're not down a lot.
Yeah.
They're down, you know, depending on the polling, depending on, you know, whether we're looking at Texas or we're looking at national aggregate polling, you know, down like 5 to 8 points, maybe in some places more like 3 to 7.
Yeah.
Now, closely divided national electorate, mobilization election, numbers have fallen among independents. He's actually not stronger.
Right.
And so I think the whole, you know, Donald Trump is like the Hulk.
Yeah.
The angrier he gets, the stronger he is kind of bullshit.
Right.
Right. And I think we need to be clear about calling bullshit on that. And so there's that. Now, in terms of, I think, you know, the Paxton thing, I mean, I think it's more interesting. And I think, you know, I mean, this is like stating the obvious in some ways. It's obviously like more helpful to him to have not been convicted than to have been convicted.
Sure.
Right. But I do think that, you know, one of the interesting things about our polling numbers this far and the kind of thing we've been, you know, the drum we've been beating kind of all summer and certainly since we got the August numbers is that people were not paying attention.
Yeah.
And that they were not, and in something that was not a top tier interest of them, as our numbers shown in August compared to other big political issues in the news. Mm-hmm. Something that they were not receiving clear, unambiguous elite signal, partisan signaling on, because in part the gag order, and in part because there were a lot of Republicans that were reticent.
Yeah,
we don't really have a good sense of what people are going to think. I mean, I would argue that, and we'll see the empirical question. Hopefully, we'll have an answer to after our next poll. You know, are people going to report having heard more about this in our next poll?
Yeah.
I don't know. I kind of think so. And I think we're also going to see relative, you know, we're now going to see more, relatively more unified Republican signaling on this that is going to break in Paxton's way.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I think it's fair to say it's a net gain for him, but I also think that, you know, to go back to, you know, the Axios Q, I wouldn't want to go too far with this.
Yeah, well, look, I think here's the key point, right? I think just to, I want to use our data for 1 second, and I think this is the key point here. We don't know yet how this has affected him, which is fine. Here's the reason I'm reluctant to say that this is some sort of net win for him. So in our last poll, right, and here we're just talking about, you know, in August of this year, right before the trial, right? You know, 23% of Republicans disapproved of the job Paxton was doing, and approval was 46%. That was the lowest approval he's had and the highest disapproval he's had among Republicans. At the beginning of this trial, 24% of Republicans, so a quarter, 1 in 4, said that, you know, basically he took actions that justify removing him from office. 1 in 4 Republicans. That is a lot.
Yeah.
Right? 28% said the Texas House was justified in impeaching him, and 23% said it was mostly based on facts. So you have about a quarter of the Republican electorate who heard about this and basically, you know, pretty much consistently said, this is a serious problem. Now, look, maybe with the verdict, they say, oh, my bad. You know, I guess he was exonerated. Everything's fine. And maybe these numbers bounce back. But having something happen that basically has a quarter of your electorate essentially turn on you, I don't see how you can interpret that in the short, medium, long term as good. I don't know how he could have that happen here. And the idea that somehow a completely different sort of nationalized version of this is filtered out in such a way, again, to a smaller share of the national audience.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you were to say right now, is Paxson strengthened or weakened by this? Based on what we know at the moment, this was not good for him. I mean, because again, you know, to your point, it's like, yes, he was exonerated. Another way to put it is the impeached attorney general, the impeached by a Republican House in Texas attorney general. I mean, there's a lot of baggage to this that I think we're gonna have to wait and sort of withhold judgment on with the polling data. But again, to sort of kind of come out of this and sort of say with such confidence, like, well, this really strengthens Paxton. And it's like, I want to just let's hold off on that. And
so you're saying it's another instance in the podcast. Well, this was before we came on, that which Nietzsche was wrong.
Oh, and with that, Nietzsche.
I think we'll see. There's a lot to unpack there, I think, in terms of how this institutional, you know, again, what the signaling is going to be like as more Republicans in particular pay attention to what they're hearing about this. You know, I mean, I think we're going to see something sort of in the middle, which is I don't know, but I kind of suspect his numbers are going to improve.
Yeah, I think they'll improve.
And will they improve dramatically? I doubt it. But, you know, among whom is also,
I think that we're going to look at, just to, you know, pull the curtain back, is, you know, does his floor and ceiling change from this? I mean, presumably a lot of people got introduced to Ken Paxton through this process who weren't paying a lot of attention to him. It's a little bit down ballot relative to the governor, the lieutenant governor, senators, things like that. You know, now that this is all kind of wrapped up and we go into the field again at some point in the not too distant future, you know, let's see what the trend lines look like.
Yeah. And, you know, whether it's a shift in direction. I mean, in a more technical sense, that's kind of what we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. The decline you were talking about was really pretty kind of steep.
Yeah, it's been ongoing and steep.
Right? And ongoing. I expect it to reverse. Will it? What is that reversal going to look like? Yeah. And so that means it won't just be the next poll.
Yeah.
And it'll be like, what are we going to see in the next three or four?
Exactly.
I think. So on that, Josh, thanks for a very stimulating discussion.
Thanks.
Thanks to all of you for listening. As always, thanks very much to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. We have talked about some data today, and as I said, we'll put a post together, if you're listening to this on a podcast platform, that will appear at our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. As soon as we wrap up here, I'll make a list of all the things I've promised and try to deliver. So thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.